May it please the Court. Good morning. Robert Swain for Appellant Joseph Scott. Joined with me is Jamie Farrar, who represents the co-defendant Dorsey. We'd like to split our time and reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
You may do so.
Your Honors, as the Court knows, in this case, the defendant entered a plea agreement that did not call for an increase for use of a minor under 3B1.4, yet before sentencing and at sentencing, neither his attorney nor the government counsel raised an objection to that increase. Our contention, of course, is that was ineffective assistance of counsel in violation of the Sixth Amendment, because the attorney certainly has a duty to try and have the court go along with the plea agreement. The government's argument now that an objection would have been frivolous means that the government entered into a plea agreement that they had no hope that would have been followed by the court. Yet, there's no new facts that were known at the time of sentencing that weren't known at the time the plea agreement was made. In fact, the only new facts that came out were Mr. Scott's statements to the probation officer, in which he reasserted that he had been brought to the scene where the van was, did not have anything to do with Ms. Dorsey, the co-defendant, prior to that moment, and had nothing to do with procuring or encouraging the children. And in fact, the probation officer recommended acceptance of responsibility. The judge gave the reduction for acceptance of responsibility. So nobody had a problem with his statement to the probation officer.
Well, counsel, I assume the plain error review applies here.
In terms of the substance of the substantive issue of whether 3B1.4 applies, yes, because there was no objection made. But, of course, that's not the same standard that the court uses to determine whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, we're not on IAC yet. But in terms of the question of whether the imposition of the enhancement for the use of the minors in the crime was erroneous as the plain error standard. I guess I have to ask you, it just seemed to me that there was so much evidence in this record about the use of these children.
Well, the evidence in the record only went to the co-defendant's use of the children.
Well, did Scott say to the officer at the station that I'm taking my children to school?
Yes, that's what the record shows. But the 3B1.4 in the commentary, and this court has said to use means to directly counsel, encourage, train, procure, recruit, solicit the minor. Not that at the time of apprehension he comes up with some quick statement of why the children are in the car.
I don't read Castro-Hernandez as being that sort of strict in terms of when the government can do this. Castro-Hernandez, the kids are in the car. I guess it's the son who's in the car. And the argument is, well, you haven't shown that he's been used in connection with, but there was enough evidence by which it could have been shown that he was. But all those sort of qualifiers you put in, I don't read those into our opinion in Castro-Hernandez.
Well, in Castro-Hernandez, it was the defendant and the defendant alone who had his own child there.
Correct.
You know, in this case, you have to remember also, it's the government's burden of proof on an enhancement like this. And there is not even evidence that Mr. Scott encouraged, recruited, counseled the co-defendant,
What are the words of the guideline? Because those, your words you just used, are not in the guideline, correct?
Well, that's the commentary to the guideline, yes.
But what are the words of the guideline?
It's to use a minor to...
as a decoy.
Well, and I think it's there's an avoid... I apologize. I can't remember the exact... language, but that language has been interpreted by Parker and Jimenez as saying, what does use mean in that sentence in the guideline to mean that the defendant has to directly do one of these actions towards the child.
But the commentary says use or attempted to use includes, and then it gives these things. Doesn't say means.
That's correct. But both Parker and Jimenez say, well, it does mean that there has to be some affirmative act along those lines. There's never been a case that says, you know, if a defendant doesn't do anything to bring, affirmatively takes no action to bring the minor into the ambit of the crime, and then simply says says a couple of words to the Border Patrol agent at the time of apprehension, that somehow is enough to show that the defendant actively, affirmatively brought the minor. The point of the guideline is, as Parker points out, it's not just that there's a minor around, it's to bring the minor into it, encourage the minor to come into it. And the facts of this case all show both Mr. Scott and the co-defendant at the time of the arrest said that they were brought separately to the scene. In Mr. Scott's probation interview, he said he was brought to the scene, had no prior contact. There's no evidence for the government to make its burden, meet its burden of proof to show that the defendant actively brought the defendant into it. And of course, if the court has some doubts as to the complete inapplicability of the guidelines, certainly there's a basis for remand so that there's an attorney who brings the objection that's outside the terms of the plea agreement so that the and can argue these things before the district court judge. There was no argument even made before the district court judge. It's certainly not a frivolous argument. And once again,
I don't think it's a frivolous argument at all, but the standard for direct review is plain error. The standard for Strickland is not whether it's frivolous. The standard is whether there's prejudice.
Correct. And on a prejudice showing, the government says, well, there could be no prejudice because this is similar to filing a motion that has no merit. Well, yeah, there has to be a reasonable chance that it would affect the outcome, but on a close call like this where to have the defense attorney advocate the lack of connection between Mr. Scott and the bringing of the children, there's certainly a reasonable possibility that that would have changed the outcome. There's no possible reason for the defense attorney not to try and ask to make the objection required and to have the court follow the plea.
And how much did the sentence, I mean, I realize we're sort of in non-guideline land, but how much does the sentence go up roughly as far as we can guess because of this particular enhancement? How many additional months went on?
Well, it raised the offense level 2 levels, so instead of a 24 to 30 month range, it was a 30 to 37 month range, and it was 33 months imposed. So if the court went mid-range, it's it'd be 6 to 8 months, something.
Yeah, that's the range we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, as the court has held, a lesser sentence like that is also prejudice.
Counsel, with respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, we do have a strong tradition in this court that we only entertain those on 2255 motions. Why should we make an exception in this case?
The court should make an exception in this case because the record shows there's no possible tactical reason to fail to raise the objection and to get the plea agreement before the court. The government's, the only response they have is, the only thing they can dream up as a tactical reason is that to increase the credibility of the attorney before the court because it was such a frivolous objection. But that's on an aspect of the plea agreement that the government itself was bound not to recommend, and there were no new facts known at sentencing than at the entry of the plea. And so there's no, the exception that this court can look to is you can see on the record there's no possible explanation, reasonable explanation, there's no possible tactical reason to not try to enforce the plea agreement and to raise an objection to an inapplicable guideline increase.
Yeah, and your client's probably now serving time.
Correct.
How much time does he have left? I'm looking at the 2255 question in terms of is there realistically time to make it given the length of the sentence and given the issue, how much time is at issue?
Well, I don't know. It's his release date now is next April.
Next, so a little over a year from now, when you say next April?
Correct.
Okay.
But, you know, when you're looking at something like this, yeah, we could wait till this is over and do the 2255 not having raised it, but there's no new information. What can the trial attorney say?
But my point is that to say wait to 2255, that's illusory. Given the time required
right.
for it to go through this, he's probably
right.
going to be out.
But certainly illusory if it ever went to the Court of Appeal, because yeah. there's no way that we could litigate the matter before the district court and get back here. So I guess I've gone over more than I thought that I would. I'd like to reserve the time and pass to co-counsel.
You may do, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Jamie Farrar, and I represent Edwina Lee Dorsey. Really, the only issue that remains for Ms. Dorsey is whether or not the Court imposed an unreasonable sentence in her case. My argument on appeal is that Judge Thompson gave undue weight to the guidelines and neglected to give sufficient weight to the 3553A factors.
What is our standard of review on this issue? It's reasonableness, right? So long as the judge addressed the 3553A factors, our review is for reasonableness?
Is that
a fair statement?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. The district court, during the plea colloquy, spoke about the weight of the guidelines that should be given by the court and spoke about the agreements between the parties as to the guidelines, and on several occasions stated that the guidelines are only one or two factors that he would take into account, that he would take them into consideration, but it doesn't go any further than that, and that the guidelines would have only a very slight effect on him when sentencing Ms. Dorsey. However, at sentencing, the court stated that the sentence will be within the guideline range. He stated that he has to establish the guideline range, as did the probation officer, that since it's a guideline sentence, it would be difficult to say that it was not avoiding unwarranted sentencing disparities because that's what the purpose of the guidelines is. In fact, the court addressed only the guidelines before he pronounced a sentence on Ms. Dorsey and stated that her sentence guideline would be 24 to 30 months and sentenced her to the mid-range of 27 months and pronounced the terms of the sentence, stated there would be no fine and imposed supervised release, and only then did he then discuss the 3553A factors.
But where did he go wrong? What was the error that would make this sentence unreasonable?
Well, Your Honor, I think that he basically just adopted what the probation officer had stated as her rationale for the sentence and did not consider any of the arguments that had been made by me on behalf of Ms. Dorsey in mitigation under the 3553A factors.
Was there any argument with respect to these considerations, or was this all by written briefs?
No, I did argue, Your Honor, and it was included in the sentencing, or in the excerpt of record, the full transcript of the sentencing hearing, where I did articulate all of the factors under 3553A that I thought the court should consider in mitigation. Additionally, at the time when Judge Thompson stated for Ms. Dorsey that he would be imposing the 3B1.4 enhancement. And our clients were sentenced separately, so my client was sentenced after Mr. Scott had been sentenced. When he stated that he was going to be imposing the 3B1.4 enhancement, he had ruled on my objection to that because I did have the opportunity to file an objection, and then I argued for a guideline variation under Cook and Kuhn and a combination of circumstances and articulated those factors as well.
But what occurs to me is that if the trial judge Thompson, having made that decision with respect to the specific sentence, entertained your argument, heard your argument, but for reasons that would presumably be reasonable, decided that he was going to go a little higher. I guess this was 18 to 24 in the plea agreement, and he actually got 27, so it's a three-month increase. I'm just having a problem. How do I get my hands around what it is that Judge Thompson did wrong?
Well, Your Honor, I think that by making the guidelines presumptive, or my argument that I believe that the court made the guidelines presumptive, he basically seems to be saying that the guidelines are where we start, it's where we stay, unless you give me a reason from which to deviate. And I think that under Zavala, this court said that is not appropriate. Your Honor, it is not just a three-month difference in reasonableness. Ms. Dorsey's plea agreement called for a low-range recommendation by the parties. It was an 18-month plea agreement that was in an 18-month sentence that was recommended by both Ms. Dorsey and the government. The sentence of 27 months is actually 9 months higher than what the plea agreement called for.
I thought it was a range, 18 to 24.
It is 18 to 24, but the actual recommendation in the sentencing summary chart that was provided to the court in the supplemental excerpt, the actual recommendation of the government and Ms. Dorsey was 18 months.
Counsel, you're down to 4 minutes. Did you want to reserve?
I will reserve, Your Honor. Thank you.
So. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nicole Jones for the United States. I'll begin with Mr. Scott's arguments regarding the use of a minor enhancement. The government's position is that under the plain error analysis, the district court did not plainly err. There was ample evidence in the record that Mr. Scott used minors to further the commission of this offense within the meaning of both the guidelines and the application note, as well as this court.
Can you fit what he did within not the meaning of the word use, which is the guideline word, but within the meaning of the specific examples in the commentary?
Yes, Your Honor. Although the government's position would be that one wouldn't necessarily need to shoehorn a defendant's actions into those specific examples.
I understand. Because it says includes, which doesn't mean means only, but can you fit what he did within any of these specific words mentioned in the commentary?
I believe that you fairly can.
Which words?
To begin with, use includes directing.
And what did he do to direct the use of these children?
Mr. Scott arrived at the location where the alien smuggling event began. He did not arrive, as far as the record reflects, with the children. They came separately. Once he arrived there, he was given fake registration documents in his name for the vehicle, a fraudulent driver's license, the vehicle containing the specialized compartment, and a fake family to present with him at the border in the form of Miss Dorsey and her three children. At the moment he took all of these implements, got into the truck, and drove to the border, at that point he was the director of the offense, if you will, in the words of the guidelines, to use the word direct. Direct means to manage or guide, to supervise, to show the way. At that point, of everyone involved, he was certainly in the role of the director. He also can fairly be said to have encouraged. At the moment he got to the border, upon questioning by the CBP officer, what is your purpose to go into the United States? I'm bringing my children to school. Why were you in Mexico? My family and I have lived in Tijuana for a year. By taking those actions in front of the children, even if he didn't directly tell them on the way to lie, which he more than likely did, but even assuming he didn't say a word to them on the way to the border, by taking those actions in front of the children at the border, he was certainly, at least implicitly, encouraging them to go along with the lie and not tell the federal officer who is in front of them, well, no, actually, this isn't my father, and we're not going to school. I don't live with him in Mexico. Moving on to, and moving past the guidelines, just the word use and what the word use normally means, Under these facts, the government believes that there's certainly sufficient evidence that he used the children as a decoy. There's, in fact, no evidence, unlike the other cases that this court has heard, Jimenez, Castro-Hernandez, and since these briefs were submitted, Preciado. In those cases, there was at least some question. The courts were required to draw an inference from actions as to what the purpose of the children being in the vehicle was. Here, we know for sure what the purpose was. Ms. Dorsey admitted that she was told to bring the children to make it easier to get across the border, and Mr. Scott admitted that he was told to act like they were his family. Under these circumstances, Pastor Hernandez says that the guideline certainly use means using as a decoy, and everybody involved used these children as a decoy. Moving on to ineffective assistance of counsel, the government's position is still that this argument isn't properly before the court on direct appeal.
What more would we learn if we postponed this to a 2255?
I believe, Your Honor, and let me begin by responding that when I, after reading the reply briefs and the word frivolous, I would say at this point that in retrospect that word certainly would not reappear in the brief, and my intention was not actually to characterize Mr. Swain's argument as frivolous. I believe Mr. Swain and the argument that has been made on appeal on behalf of Mr. Scott is the best argument that could possibly be made. The government does not believe it's accurate, but it's a very good argument. But ineffective assistance of counsel does not require counsel to come up with the very best argument possible.
No, let me stick with the question as to whether we should get to it now. The reason, if it's not already clear, here's the essential basis for my question. Ordinarily, we do postpone IAC claims either to 2255, or the state court will postpone them until later, and then eventually we get them 2254. The reason for that is usually for an IAC claim, you've got to go outside the record. That is, it'll be the defense attorney didn't interview these three witnesses that I presented to him as valid alibi witnesses, etc. But I don't see any need to go outside the record. So tell me why we should postpone this IAC claim to 2255.
I see, Your Honor. I apologize.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
I believe the point that the government was attempting to make in the brief is that we, at this, based on this record, we don't know why counsel before the district court made the decisions that she made. That would be the only reason we're relying.
I see. You think the counsel could have had a good reason? I can't imagine one.
Your Honor, from the record, I agree with you. Counsel should have raised the objection to preserve it and to make it. What the government believes happened, based on reading what counsel did argue at the hearing, is that she was attempting to parlay it into a minor role reduction. Strategically, she appeared to be fighting for the minor role reduction. My reading of the record is that she did not see this particular argument that use requires it to be the parent or the person physically putting someone in the car, that use means use, and the record was clear that there was admissions that they were using the children as a decoy, and that strategically her decision was to use that. She even said it in the record, if Your Honor is inclined to use the use of a minor enhancement, I would ask for minor role. I believe she made that argument twice. She did make the equitable arguments that are being made on appeal, that Mr. Scott wasn't the children's parents. He wasn't really responsible for them showing up in the first place, that he didn't use his own children. So strategically, that would be the reason the government would proffer as perhaps why she chose the route that she did. The breach of the plea agreement argument hasn't been raised yet, but that was covered in the briefing, and what the government would say on that point is that the government counsel was not required under the terms of the plea agreement to make any objections or any affirmative arguments during sentencing. The government submitted a sentencing summary chart in accordance with the plea agreement, and the government also at sentencing, although after sentence had already been pronounced, attempted to put on the record that the government was still recommending a 24-month sentence in accordance with the plea agreement. Counsel's comments with the court at most were merely acknowledging that his prior statement regarding the order of the application of the enhancements was not correct, and then counsel sat down. The government does not see how that can be termed a breach of the plea agreement, and even if it was, it was waived. Finally, as to sentencing, beginning with Scott and then to Ms. Dorsey, Judge Thompson in this case made it very clear in both sentencings that he would calculate the guidelines and consider the guidelines, but that he was not considering the guidelines to be presumptive or mandatory in any way. In both cases, he went through each of the 3553A factors. He gave extensive reasoning based on history and characteristics of the defendants, the seriousness of the offenses, and the nature of the crimes. And a fair reading, particularly in Mr. Scott's case of the sentencing transcript, is that that the judge's reasoning was that the more systemic purposes of sentencing were well served by a guidelines sentence. And under Gall, which also came out more recently, and under the statements in Rita about that the courts must always keep guidelines in the forefront of their mind, that the guidelines were the product of reasoned study, and that it's fair to assume that a guideline sentence is a rough approximation of the appropriate sentence, that Judge Thompson in this case did not err and certainly was not unreasonable in giving his sentencing in either case. As specifically to Ms. Dorsey, in that case, he even went further. He did give the guidelines first and pronounced sentence and then gave his reasoning. He began by stating that this took him quite a bit of time, and said the reason for that was the quality of defense counsel's submissions. She submitted memorandums. She submitted multiple letters from defendant's family. And then Judge Thompson continued to go through each of the 3553A factors. Under this record, he certainly considered everything that he was required to consider, went through it in detail, and his sentence was reasonable.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Swain, between you, you have about 4 minutes.
Your Honor, and I will submit on Ms. Dorsey's behalf, so Mr.
Swain. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Swain.
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the enhancement, the government simply has not shown a way to distinguish this case from Parker and Jimenez. In fact, there's less evidence because there's no evidence that Mr. Scott even knew there were going to be minors there when he was recruited to be the driver. When he agreed to be the driver, he was brought to the scene.
He could have stepped out of the car and said, get somebody else to drive this with these kids in here.
Well, then he wouldn't even
he
be...
He didn't have to stay in the car and start driving when the children got in.
Well, then he wouldn't even be here for any criminal offense.
I think that's right.
and so, but by the same token...
The government didn't put those kids in.
Well, in Jimenez, it was the parent himself who put, or herself, I guess, that put the child in the car, and there was insufficient evidence in that case. This is even more removed because it's not Mr. Scott who brought the children, who did any encouragement or action.
The judge point out that with three children in the car, you can even get an upward departure for extra children.
Well, I think that the court was talking about the fact that in the compartment there were, being smuggled, there was children in the compartment. I think that's what the court was referring to. And
well, if the court wasn't referring to that, it should have been referring to Application Note 3. If defendant used or attempted to use more than one person less than 18, an upward departure may be warranted.
Yeah, that wasn't referenced below, but again, there's... If in a case in a bank robbery, the co-participant in the bank robbery is a minor and the defendant knows it And that's insufficient because there wasn't affirmative evidence that the defendant brought the minor into the offense. If in a case where the parent, him or herself, brings the child along, and that's insufficient, how can it be sufficient that the only link, the only thread that the government's argument rests on is that at the time of apprehension at the border, he tries to come up with a cover story in order to get through? That is not the same as actively intimidating or bringing the witnesses in. As far as the ineffective assistance claim, I think the government conceded that the argument should have been made. The government suggests, well, you're not entitled to a good argument. Well, there was no argument on the increase. And there's nothing more that would be gained by starting the process again on a 2255.
We would have to, if we were going to do this on this record, we would have to say that there was a Strickland violation because for some reason counsel didn't remind the judge of the terms of the plea agreement. And the explanation, we don't know what it might be. Maybe he was intimidated by this particular judge or by the circumstances of the case. Or maybe she was. I don't remember now. But what this court tries to avoid doing is speculating on a record on appeal as to matters that might come up in a hearing and a post-conviction proceeding. And usually in a habeas proceeding, you bring in the witnesses. They testify what they were thinking about, what they were doing, why they didn't do it, and so on. And then the district judge makes a Strickland analysis. We rarely do this on a record like this.
I understand that. But as the government's conceded, they can't come up with any reason why there wouldn't be an objection.
Well,
and there's
I don't think the government quite conceded that. She said that, but then she said, but, you know, I can see kind of what the defense lawyer was thinking about. She was trying to use this to get minimization and so on. And,
but, of course, that argument was precluded by the plea agreement. Asking for a minor role was precluded from the plea agreement. And I just repeat one final thing. There were no new facts known at the time that the plea, from when the time when the plea was entered. So what is happening is the defendant is entering a plea agreement that the government and his attorney know cannot be followed and not even be attempted to have the court comply with. That can't be. That's not fair.
The government did make their, at least token effort to ask for or recommend a slightly lower sentence, as they had agreed to do, and they kept their part of the agreement. Otherwise, you'd be in here arguing that they breached the plea agreement in failing to make the recommendation.
Well, we argue they did breach by failing to object to the enhancement and by failing to...
Well, if they make their point, make the recommendation, they don't have to object if the judge doesn't buy it.
Well, but then the later colloquy between the court and the government attorney was the government attorney thought that that enhancement happened before the increase to level 18, and when the judge correctly said, no, that is enhanced after, the government's response is, oh, okay. That's not the case like in the Maldonado case where the government still stood by the recommendation and said, well, no, the government said, oh, okay. That's a far cry from delivering a plea agreement, I think.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank
the
you,
case just argued will be submitted for decision, and the court will adjourn.
All rise. All those having had business before this honorable court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, shall now depart. This court stands adjourned.